You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There were around 4,500 inmates in Haiti's National Penitentiary on January 12, 2010, the day a devastating earthquake struck near Port-au-Prince. Like many buildings in the nation's capital, the jail crumbled, and that allowed all the inmates, thieves, murderers, and powerful gang leaders to escape. Tomorrow marks the first anniversary of the earthquake, and tonight at 9 p.m. on PBS, a new Frontline report produced by Dan Reed examines what happened at the prison and how police are struggling to recapture the criminals who escaped and are terrorizing the country once again. Dan Reeds joins us now from London to discuss the film called Battle for Haiti. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you doing?
What determines the subject of a documentary that you make, like the one about the terror attacks in Mumbai in 2008 and this one about the escaped inmates from Haiti's National Penitentiary?
Well, the terror in Mumbai, which was an HBO documentary I made in 2009, was an attempt to go inside, behind the scenes in a terrorist attack. And I was lucky enough to get hold of the telephone intercepts, the recorded cell phone conversations between the terrorists on the ground, the gunmen, and their masters in Pakistan, sitting in, you know, anonymous men sitting in safety somewhere in a room and directing these young guys. And so you got a kind of an unprecedented inside view inside the minds of these young men and the older guys as the attack was taking place. Haiti was a different kind of assignment. It was really about trying to understand why it was so difficult for Haiti to recover from not just the earthquake, but a series of natural and political disasters that occurred in the past couple of decades. So the jailbreak, the mass escape of not just the 4,500 prisoners from the National Penitentiary, but another 1,000 or so from another 7 jails around Haiti. And I was trying to use that as a way into understanding the problems that the country had prior to the earthquake. And the main problem was the lack of a functioning state and the lack of a justice system. And this has actually had huge consequences for not just for Haiti in general, but for the earthquake recovery project.
So you look at the story of escaped criminals as a way of examining the impact of corruption in almost every aspect of Haitian life.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of difficult to call it. It is corruption. It's difficult to sort of single out corruption as something separate from the general dysfunctionality of every single institution that underpins what we'd call, you know, a normal civilized institutionalized existence. You know, when the courts don't function, it means that you can't sift the bad guys from the good guys. And when you can't do that, you're arresting people, but you're throwing them into a system where maybe a guy who stole a chicken and a guy who murdered two people are in the same cell, and because the guy who murdered two people might have more influential friends or might be connected with wealthy criminals on the outside, that person might get out sooner than the guy who stole a chicken, who doesn't have the money. And so as soon as that happens and there's no resort to justice in a society, the institutional fabric begins to break down, because it doesn't just affect criminal issues of law and order. It also affects trying to find out who owns the piece of land you're trying to rent to build a factory on, trying to find out the identities of your coworkers, or trying to find out the identity of someone you've arrested. And so it has tremendous repercussions right through Haitian society.
They jam these inmates into small cells, and you mentioned the hardened criminals with people who may have stolen a chicken. Also, there's no attempt to separate adults and adolescents. Did the conditions lead to high rates of tuberculosis and HIV among the prisoners?
Well, I think they must do. I mean, health care in the prison is extremely basic. A number of prisoners told me that when someone got sick, they were thrown on a sandpit outside and kind of left alone for 3 days, and if they croaked, then they were taken off in a cart and dumped somewhere, and if they didn't, then they got to go to the clinic. That's probably a an extreme version of what happens, because I know there is a dispensary, there is a clinic, which in the prison, I'm talking about the prison civile, the main prison in Port-au-Prince, but a lot of prisoners said there's just one pill they give out for any ailment. You know, you go there, you get the pill, and you get sent back to your cell. So I'm assuming that TB and AIDS are rife there. I mean, it's, you know, getting sent to that jail, whatever crime you committed or haven't committed can easily be a death sentence.
You point out in the film that accurate records have not been kept. So do we know if it was really 45 inmates that escaped? And do we know whether people escaped before the earthquake hit?
Well, it seems to be every sort of 5 or 6 years, there's a mass breakout from the jail. The last mass breakout before the earthquake was in 2004, when the government of Jean Bertrand Aristide was toppled. And the political upheaval was used as a kind of cover to... I don't know quite how this worked, but you know, everyone escaped from the jail, and sums of money were paid. And the earthquake was somewhat different because it was a natural disaster, and the prison was physically damaged. Although the walls didn't actually crumble and fall down, but there was enough damage to the prison structure to allow people to get out. And of course, there were not enough guards. There was something like 15 guards trying to stop 4,500 prisoners escaping. The figure of 4,500 comes from a list of escapees, which is flawed and by no means comprehensive, but it's the best list. It was a list that was, I believe, compiled partly by the UN mission there. But any information you get in Haiti, any names, any hard data is I would always question as being of dubious value. Just from my experience of trying to locate prisoners from that list, I met prisoners who told me, yeah, well, this is my name, but here's the false name I gave when I was taken to prison. And sure enough, that name appears on the prisoners list. So it's part of this overall dysfunctionality of the state and of institutions in Haiti that you can't really find out who anyone is.
Well, one prisoner tells you everyone escaped except for the dead. Is it known how many inmates died in the earthquake?
Well, I know of 5 who died. But no, we don't know. Some prisoners told me that the guards opened fire. There were contradictory accounts of this. Others, prison guards, told me that they fired in the air. But nobody really knows, and nobody will ever find out how many people died in the prison escape. We only know of 4 or 5 who died for sure.
My guest is Dan Reed, who is the producer of a PBS Frontline report on the current situation in Haiti, focusing on the 4,500 or so inmates who escaped from Haiti's national penitentiary on the day of the earthquake, which will be 1 day, 1 year from tomorrow. Another 1,000, you point out, escaped from other prisons. I assume there's also a woman's prison or two. The show will be broadcast tonight at 9 p.m. on PBS stations. When the UN supposedly has been improving conditions at the prison, how is it any better than it was before?
Not really. I've had a look inside the main prison block, which has been nicknamed the Titanic. The prisoners call it the Titanic, and it's a fearsome looking cube of concrete with these kind of rusting hoods on the outside of the windows, so you can't see up to the sky. And what's happening now, the UN-funded refurbishment is creating kind of like shelves within these cells. These are pretty small cells which can contain up to 300 guys. So there isn't, in the past there wasn't room even for people to sit down at night. So a lot of people spent the night standing up. A lot of the convicts spent the night standing up. I call them convicts. Most of the men in the prison were never convicted of a crime.
They never saw a judge.
Between 80 and 90% of the prisoners in the jail at the time of the earthquake had never been to court, had never been tried for any crime.
One of them tells you that when somebody gets sick and gets moved, that's when you get a space. to sit down or lie down.
His story is when someone dies, that's when you get a space on the ground, on the floor of the cell. So a guy dies during the night, and this is one of the escaped prisoners who's been recaptured, and he's on his way. He's in a police holding cell. I'm interviewing him in a police holding cell on his way back to the prison, and he's saying, you know, the conditions are so crowded that when a guy dies in the night, the gang soldiers pick him up, as is the junior gang members, they pick him up and they prop him up in the corner, and then so that someone can take his space and lie down where the man was, like, drooling as he died, or, you know, bodily fluids on the floor. So this conjures a picture of unbelievable horror for me, a place where you cannot even lie down to sleep. And so much so that a lot of prisoners have suffer from swollen legs because they're standing up for 24 hours and more at a time.
Before we start feeling too much sympathy for these people, many of them are really awful criminals. When they escape, where did they go? Did they go back to where they'd lived before?
A lot of them went back to, I mean, there was a mixture of trajectories, if you like, for the escaped prisoner. A lot of the guys, as I said, who were in the prison should never have been there in the first place, but there were also a lot of very bad, you know, hardened gang leaders and rapists, kidnappers, drug dealers, who some of whom skipped the country. Others went back to the areas they had controlled in the very turbulent years before the earthquake, and I should add that some measure of calm had been brought to Haiti by a very determined assault on certain slum neighborhoods during which gang leaders had been killed and a lot of them had been taken to jail. So there was a partial success in subduing the gang problem in Haiti. So in the areas that had been hit by the UN troops and the Haitian police, often the gangsters who went back there got lynched and, you know, kind of chopped, macheted to pieces, and their bodies left by the side of the road. In other areas, they managed to retake control and reassert the control they had before. But, I mean, this is a huge number of dangerous gangsters re-entering a society which was really on its knees. You know, after the earthquake, people, obviously a million people lost their homes, a quarter of a million people had died, and Haitians were at their most vulnerable. And this was a society, you know, the last thing Haitians needed was a plague of gangsters. And very soon, a lot of the tent camps where earthquake survivors had set up home, you know, as far away from any buildings as they could in all the open spaces of the city. A lot of these tent camps were taken over by gangsters, and that's why you have now this epidemic of rapes, which has occurred in the 12 months since the quake.
Is it known how many rapes are being committed in the camps? And what happens when when the police are called in? Do the rape victims have any recourse?
Very little recourse. The two, I mean, I met a number of rape victims, but of the two who I interviewed in the film, one of them was told to, she went to make a complaint to the police, which is a brave thing to do for a rape victim. Most of them do not report the crime. But she went to the police, and the cop said, when you catch the guy who raped you, just call us. The other girl was told by the guys who raped her, she was raped by four men who had escaped from the penitentiary. And she was told, if you report this to the police, we'll kill your mother, your grandmother, and your little brother, so we'll wipe out your family. And, you know, she had to take that seriously, I guess, and so that crime went unreported. I'm convinced the majority of rapes go unreported, and I'm also convinced that the number of rapes since the earthquake goes into the thousands.
And not just rapes. You have one horrible story where a woman was not only raped, but then they kicked her stomach, and she wound up aborting. Well, she wound up with all sorts of problems.
Yeah, this is a woman who had. I wanted to illustrate, you know, in Haiti, people don't get any help whatsoever from their government. So if you're a Haitian, if you're a poor Haitian, you're completely on your own. And the only way you can make money is by starting up your own little business. So this woman had started up a street stall selling fried food. The local criminals used to come by and just steal from her stall. And then, you know, one day, one of them kicked from the he kicked a tub of boiling oil over her, and she was 8 months pregnant, and she lost a child. And then the family scraped together some money to purchase, more goods to make more fried food, and then that was stolen again, and then the earthquake happened. And their home, they lived in a rented home near the prison. Their home was looted. So it's this, Haiti's a difficult enough place to make a living without then the small amount of money that you managed to put together being taken from you by robbers. And we found this story over and over and over again at the most vulnerable levels of Haitian society, that ordinary people who are trying to put a living together, who are trying to scrape together the money to send their kids to school, because, again, there's no state provision for schooling, are just getting hijacked and robbed and ground down by this constant attrition of crime.
And that poor woman bled for 22 days. I'm talking to Dan Reed, who is the producer of a Frontline report on Haiti, what's happened in the year since the earthquake, 1 year ago tomorrow. It'll be broadcast tomorrow night, at 9 p.m. on PBS stations, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dan Reed, producer of a Frontline report called Battle for Haiti, which will be broadcast tonight at 9 p.m. on PBS stations. I saw a news report on one of our local news shows last night about Haitian-American members of the New York Police Department who've gone to Haiti to help out. But it's my sense from seeing your film that this is a hopeless situation. The cops are just outnumbered and in some cases corrupt themselves.
Yeah, it's. I'd say that's an accurate assessment. Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to find, and I'm the last person to want to present a bleak picture of a country that needs all the help it can get, and I really wouldn't want with my film to discourage anyone from trying to help Haiti. But I think it's very important to understand the truth of the situation and to understand the chronic problems which affect Haiti and which are making it so difficult to actually get help to where it's needed. And law and order and the rule of law is, I would say, the most important problem of all. And this is not just according to the head of the UN mission, who in the film says, unless we can establish the rule of law, then everything else the international community and the UN is doing will be in vain.
Well, how much support does the Haitian police force get from UN peacekeeping forces?
The Haitian police get a tremendous amount of support. The UN peacekeeping forces are there in strength. There are 12,000 uniformed personnel, including, thousands of Brazilian soldiers. They have armored personnel carriers. They have all the modern weapons. But what they don't have is intelligence, inside information about what's happening. Haiti's a very complex place to understand, and the language that people speak is not even, a lot of people do speak French, but most people speak and communicate in Creole, Haitian Creole, which is a language that only a tiny percentage of the UN peacekeeping troops will understand. And unless you know the language, you can't really begin to decode everything that's happening on the ground, particularly in very complex situations like these tent camps and the slum neighborhoods. And so they're very reliant on the Haitian police for their intelligence. I went on a number of operations, snatch operations with the UN peacekeepers. And so you've got, you'll have 300 or 400 troops, which they'll throw a cordon, they'll seal off an area, and then SWAT teams will go in. But the whole thing depends on a vital piece of information from an informer, from someone inside the community. And unless that piece of information is accurate, the whole operation is a waste of time. And I found that time and again, the information that they had on these operations was unreliable, and the operation yielded, as far as I could see, very few results. And it's not from the lack of trying. I mean, the UN peacekeepers are really, there are a lot of good guys in there who are busting a gut to try and make a difference. And the same in the Haitian police. But the Haitian police are undermanned, they're underfunded, there is corruption within the force. And the lack of a justice system means that even if the cops arrest 50 bad guys, those bad guys could just get thrown into a system where they'll probably get away, or you know, at least the serious bad guys will get away because they'll be well connected and they'll bribe a judge, or one of their friends will bribe a judge, or you know, the police evidence will be so contaminated that the court case will result in nothing, or it'll never go to court and the guy will be let out the back door. I mean, it's an unbelievably flawed system. So what I'm saying really is, even if the Haitian cops were the best cops in the world, they would still struggle to make a difference because the courts and the prisons are so dysfunctional.
A portion of your film, in a portion of your film, you follow police forces as they hunt for escapees. Did the police like having you around?
Well, they did. I mean, you might say that's a bit strange because, in places, I'm fairly critical of what's going on. I think, you know, a lot of cops really want to make a difference. A lot of cops, they understand that what they're doing is sometimes no more than a facade, a charade of keeping. Oops, I'm sorry, I just dropped my phone. A charade which results in, you know, a bunch of guys being carted off in the back of pickup trucks and handed over to this flawed justice system. But so a lot of them really welcomed the fact that he was an outsider who seemed to give a damn about the country and what was going on, to try and reestablish security. But a lot of times as well, there was mistrust, and a lot of times there was a level of caution because it seemed that pretty much everyone had something to hide.
Well, one officer actually says to an escapee that they have recaptured, "I'm going to beat the crap out of you."
Yeah.
And then another one says, regarding a roundup of alleged criminals, "We arrested 55, we released 52. We think they're gangsters."
Yes. I mean, the guy who says we think they're gangsters is he's a victim of the complete lack of reliable information. He doesn't really know that whether these guys are gangsters or not. He's saying that they're gangsters on the basis that a bunch of men from the neighborhood where they conducted the arrests did not recognize the guys who were arrested. Did not recognize them as being from the area. So just the mere fact that they were outsiders to the area made them kind of potential suspects. I don't have to tell you how flawed that is, how unacceptable that would be in a modern, in anywhere like New York or London or whatever. But the Haitian police is doing what it can, and the UN is backing up this very flawed system, which sometimes seems absurd. You know, you have policemen from Spain or from the States or from wherever, from France, Canada, who are going along with this, what to me was an extremely random system of identifying people to arrest. As for beating the crap out of the guys they arrested, this often happens. Haitians seem to expect a beating when they're arrested. It seems to be the sort of standard procedure, I'm afraid. People are taken to a cell and given a bit of a beating to see whether they'll reveal any useful information. There appears to be very little evidence gathering. There's very little forensic science. How do you get evidence out of someone except by beating a confession out of them? I mean, it's appalling, but it happens.
My guest is Dan Reed, a producer of a new Frontline report on Haiti called Battle for Haiti, which will be broadcast at 9 p.m. tonight on PBS stations. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's a scene in the film where a man who claims he's innocent, as many of these people do, turns out to actually be innocent, and the police let him go, but 30 miles from his home, and he has to find a way to get back home. You were in that van that whole time, or somebody, your film crew was in that van.
Yeah.
That must have been an incredible experience.
It was, Leonard. It was extremely hot to begin with. It was so hot that our skin wrinkled up. Like when you spent too long in the bath. We were just, our clothes were soaked in perspiration, and we were spending hours at a time in the back of this truck that was getting driven in a very adventurous and vigorous way around the potholes of Port-au-Prince and elsewhere. So we were. It was a surreal when we went on several trips with them, it was a really surreal trip. And more and more of these arrested escapees kept getting pulled into the back, and so the cameraman and the sound recordist and I were squeezing into a tighter and tighter space. But you can't help feeling ambivalent towards these guys. On the one hand, they really care about their job, and they really want to put away the gangsters who escaped from the jail. They know what some of these criminals are capable of. They've seen it firsthand. They themselves are men who are hunted by the escaped gangsters because there's a struggle for survival between the hunters and the hunted. At the same time, when they're slapping around a guy who turns out to be innocent, you think, well, guy, what are you doing? Why did you have to do that? So I came away feeling split, feeling in two minds, and ended up concluding, these are guys who are really trying their best in a system which makes them behave in a certain way to get results. And what you need, of course, is institutional change. Quite how that can be achieved, I really don't know.
After the earthquake, foreign governments pledged $10 billion in aid. The American Red Cross reports contributing almost $250 million to the recovery effort in the first year, with another $250 million to come in subsequent years. In addition, the Red Cross claims to have sent materials, expertise, and hope to the people of Haiti. There are other NGOs that are also working there. But on the basis of what you show in your film, little progress seems to have been made.
That's right. I think, the emergency relief effort in the couple of months after the earthquake was actually quite effective. I think there was a period of chaos initially, because the UN itself had been really badly hit and lost a lot of personnel. And so there was, a couple of weeks of real chaos. And then once the aid organizations started getting their act together, a lot of food and water was distributed, a lot of tents were distributed, and there wasn't an epidemic of disease in the camps where the survivors went to live. So you could say that the emergency phase of the earthquake aid operation was very successful. But now you have these vast tent camps, or about 1,200 tent camps all over the earthquake zone, and particularly in the capital, Port-au-Prince. And the emergency period is officially over, and now Haiti is trying to get into reconstruction and to try and rebuild and disperse the tent camps and get survivors accommodated somewhere else. And that is what has been completely unsuccessful. I'd say very little difference has been made to the lives of the earthquake survivors.
And now there's typhus. Are the NGOs more of a problem than a help these days?
Well,
Some people in your film talk about the problems that are caused by Haitians expecting handouts rather than actually doing things to help themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are two. This was an interview with one of the community leaders in Cité Soleil, which is the biggest slum neighborhood in Port-au-Prince. And she was sitting there on her stool, and this is a lady who sells plates of spaghetti in the evening from a little shop. And she was saying, people need to get off their backsides, if I can put it that way. And the people have become lazy because they've been accustomed to receiving handouts, and what they need is jobs. And this was echoed by pretty much every Haitian I spoke to. We don't want handouts. We don't want to be given stuff. We want to work. We want to do stuff to earn money. We want to, be able to have some self-respect. And I think the culture of dependency has really undermined some aspects of Haitian society, and Haitians resent it. By and large, they resent the presence of all these foreigners driving around in big new 4x4 trucks and eating in the nice restaurants up in the hills, and obviously costing the aid organizations a lot of money. And the Haitians on the ground are not seeing much benefit from this. And there's another aspect to the NGO, the presence of non-governmental organizations and charities, which is also, I think, detrimental, and which the head of the UN mission was particularly passionate about. And he said, look, Haiti has become a republic of NGOs. There are 10,000, this figure he quoted, an unbelievable figure of 10,000 NGOs in Haiti. And this is a problem because a lot of the aid money that goes into the country has been rooted through these NGOs and not through the Haitian state. So as the NGOs have grown, the Haitian state has withered away. Now, you can't have a country without a functioning state. Nothing gets done. You know, the NGOs are not acting in conjunction with the government. Their efforts are not being coordinated by any central agency. So it's kind of chaotic, and a lot of money is getting frittered away. It's like water poured on sand. And so what needs to happen, and it's a lot, and it's complex because of corruption, because the machinery of government doesn't exist anymore in Haiti, in any real sense. But we have to start feeding aid through the Haitian state, through Haitian organizations, through the Haitian government. Otherwise, we will end up completely killing, making Haiti into a completely moribund and ineffectual country where nothing can get done by anyone, including the NGOs.
We have just a few moments left, but isn't the Obama administration considering rejecting the results of the presidential election that was held this past November? And you have the head of the police suggesting that perhaps democratic institutions aren't the best way to go for Haiti. I don't know whether he's suggesting a dictatorship.
He's not suggesting dictatorship, but you know he's suggesting what a lot of Haitians that I spoke to, in fact, to a man and a woman, Haitians want a strong government, and they're not getting that by the democratic process as it currently can be found in Haiti. The problem is that so many Haitians are by most of the Haitians population is illiterate. Democracy ought to work as people making an informed choice on the basis of good information about who they want to be governed by. It doesn't work that way in Haiti. So what happens is you have community gangsters who are in charge of who control large areas of the slum neighborhoods who deliver votes to politicians in return for favors and money. And that's not how democracy should work. And it's a distortion of the democratic ideal we would all subscribe to. And so what's happening is that, ironically, the democratic process is just creating further confusion in Haiti. I very much doubt that anyone wants to transform Haiti from a democratically governed country to a dictatorship. No one wants that. But some other mode of government has to be found because democracy isn't working in Haiti. And we need to preserve the power of the people to choose their leaders without having this chaos and the votes for sale and the perpetuation of corruption at all levels of government. As the police chief says in the film, in Haiti, honest people do not go into politics, and that's something we have to change.
So, earthquake or no earthquake, is the situation in Haiti hopeless?
The situation isn't hopeless because Haitians are resourceful, energetic, by and large, very, very get up and go people, and they're amazing survivors. In fact, their ability to survive kind of holds them back in a way because they're able to make do with so little, and they're able to get by even when their leaders give them no help whatsoever. But I think in order for there to be real hope, there has to be some. I would suggest that foreign organizations should withdraw from Haiti as much as possible and let the Haitians sort things out for themselves. And we should build roads for them. We should build big infrastructure projects that Haiti simply could not afford. But otherwise, we should get out of there and let the Haitians sort things out for themselves. I think that is, give them some power because we've been treating them as victims for too long. And I think the longer we treat them as victims, the less hope there will be for Haiti.
Dan Reed is the producer of a PBS Frontline report called Battle for Haiti, which will be broadcast tonight. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.